Welcome to Common, Press TV's live show that gives you the chance to have your say on what's happening in the world. I'm Phil Rees, and in the next 50 minutes, I want to talk to you. It's only a debate if you join in. I'm in London, but wherever you are, we want to hear from you. And we'll call you back, so don't worry about the phone bill. And I'm not George Galloway, and he does send his regards, by the way. And he can't be with you tonight, unfortunately, but you can join me for the great debate. Call on +44 208 601 4555. You can also SMS on +44 7800 008066. Or if you prefer to email, send it to comment@presstv.co.uk. So pick up the phone, send an email. There is plenty to talk about. It's been another momentous week in this incredible year. In Yemen, tens of thousands of demonstrators took to the streets today in the country's second city, Taiz, after security forces killed at least 15 and injured many more. Can President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who has ruled for more than three decades, can he cling on to power? What about Bahrain? With Saudi troops now in the country to support King Hamad Al Khalifa, Bahrain has become a police state. There have been mass arrests. Government workers have been fired. There have been accounts of torture. And the forced resignation of the editor of the nation's only independent newspaper. Well, in Libya, at least 15 rebel fighters have been killed by a NATO airstrike. It's the second such incident in recent days involving international forces deployed to protect Libyan civilians. What's your view on that? And in the Ivory Coast, French forces used helicopter gunships to target the army of Laurent Gbagbo, the now nearly toppled Ivorian leader who refused to give up power after he lost elections last November. Well, was the UN right to intervene there? Or is it just a cover for France to make another grab for its old colonies in Africa? We need your comment. I should state from the very start that any views I express in the next hour are purely my own, and not those of Press TV. The show is not scripted and is broadcast live, and it's all about you voicing your thoughts. So please, call me now. There's a great deal to talk about. As you know and can see, I'm not George Galloway. I'm Phil Rees, and I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've worked much of it in the Middle East. I've covered conflicts from Afghanistan to Pakistan to South America. I've been with Hezbollah guerrillas. I've made a point of covering groups that the West call terrorists, and I would prefer to call resistance organizations. So I have a lot to say also about how the media works. And if you want to know about maybe how the presentation of certain stories is in the media, then do let me know. And I do think we now have our first caller, which is Niza. Niza, not sure if you're in London, I believe, nearby, and you want to talk about Bahrain. Niza, how are you?
Oh, fine, Phil. Can you hear me clearly?
I can hear you, Niza. Yes, please.
Okay, lovely. Okay, Phil, good. Peace be on you. What I want to say was, you know, why Muslims and people of conscience should not be surprised by atrocities committed by the Saudi army in Bahrain, including the desecration of mosques, plus Quran burning. Now, you know, they have done this before, right in the midst of Islam's most holiest place, Haram al-Sharif in Mecca, early 70s, 400 Saudi protesters butchered, and then in early 80s, 450 pilgrims murdered with the help of French snipers. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, here in the UK, the 2 million strong Muslims, please wake up and postpone your Umrah, Hajj, for 3 to 4 years. I said postpone. See, until this royal family, the House of Saud, the so-called custodians of the Holy Mosque,
And that's an insult, isn't it, to call them that? You know, they've been involved in so much corruption.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them on gambling and in sexual misdeeds. I mean, it's a tragedy for the Islamic world that they are the guardians of the holy sites.
But, you know, but these people, if they postpone until these authorities return to the pure, unadulterated teachings of the Prophet, peace be upon him. Okay, this may just be a symbolic gesture, but it will at least save us £75 million annually, UK alone. This money can be used for our homeless, poor people in Britain and elsewhere. Charities, human rights, Stop the War, Palestinian Solidarity, university students. And most importantly, it will help the Lion of Scotland, also known as the Commander of the Voiceless, to continue fight for justice. What do you think?
Well, it's a difficult one. Thank you for that call, Nazir. I mean, obviously, it's difficult for Muslims when they have duty to do Hajj, not to turn their backs on Saudi Arabia. But certainly, I think Saudi Arabia's role in the Middle East, and remember, many in the West still use the word moderate about them, of course, because they're allies of the West, make them a country that people don't really realize the extent of the brutality and suppression there. Now, we have another call, this time from north of England, from Manchester. We have Shakat, if I pronounced you right. Thank you for joining us, Shakat.
Yeah, fine. Hello there, Phil.
Hello, mate.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you two questions, Phil. Okay?
Go ahead, my friend.
Well, the first question is the NATO's intervention in Libya is clearly not working. It's not protecting the people it went into for, and it's certainly not diminishing the Gaddafi's evil forces. Now, if they decide to arm the rebels and train them up and send so-called, you know, the missionaries like in, what they did in Iraq and Afghanistan into Libya, you know, it would be a bloodbath. It would be 10 times worse than Afghanistan, with over hundreds of tribes and only five that have got influence. And the second question I want to ask you, Phil, is if there is no end game for NATO in Libya, do you think, like I do, that they will start securing all the oil fields and the towns and leave the rest of Libya in lurch? Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, some very important questions. I mean, obviously, it's your comments we want to hear, but I mean, in terms of what I think about that, look, the no-fly zone was introduced. It was introduced very stupidly because a no-fly zone doesn't achieve very much in the end. So in the sense, it had to have mission creep involved in it. Now, in terms of the oil, of course, France and Britain are very much involved in the oil there. And I think what you'll find is that they are trying to basically manage the fighting groups in the resistance. We know that Britain sent members of its security apparatus, MI6, there. The Americans are training some people. There's a lot of mysterious things going on there. So I think what the West is trying to do is try to actually manage that. But, you know, Libya is very complicated. There are tribal divisions. Historically, when the Italians invaded in 1911, Libya was two countries in a way, or it was actually three divisions of the Ottoman Empire. So there are long-standing divisions there. But it's very complicated, and it's easier to get into a war than to get out of it. John from the UK is next on the line, and thank you for those comments, Shokat. John, please.
Hello.
Hello, John. What have you got to say, sir?
Okay. I'd like to talk to you about the greater picture of what is happening in the East, if I may. You know, get away a little bit from the details of different sort of locations, but talk about the trend, if I may. The way I see this, I see what's happening now, I see this very much as the Eastern world being in transition, that if one can make an East-West dichotomy, the West had its renaissance soon after the Middle Ages, and one might say similar things are happening in the East, that this is the beginnings or the inceptions of the Eastern Renaissance. In the 70s, a famous German economist, Schumacher, wrote the famous book Small is Beautiful, that shows the globe coming out of an eggshell. And the theme there was very much issues about the global village and world governance. And I think also one of the British prime ministers was very keen on these issues. The Tory one before Margaret Thatcher, his name escapes me.
Yeah, Edward Heath.
Edward Heath, exactly.
Oh, John Major, I think.
He was very much into this. He was very worried about that, you know, people with massive powers could make decisions. Let's say if you upset the Saudis, tomorrow they could pull out of the UK Council a massive several billion dollar contract and cause chaos. and give it to somebody else. And he was saying that really, this is not, these are very unstabilizing way of going about, and we need to have better systems of...
Well, John, decisions. I mean, I think the point you understand about the Middle East, of course, that for centuries it's been controlled, manipulated, its leaders corrupted by the West as a means of control. So, yes, one is seeing a rebirth. One is seeing an attempt for one region of the world to take control of its destiny. I mean, no one could possibly argue that that shouldn't be the case, yet that has been the case. And I think once that happens, I think other things will evolve. Once they can control their own destiny, I think they'll have their own identity. And the leaders who are in power because of their deals with the West will find their positions under threat. And I think it may not happen overnight, but this is where the world is going. And I think for the Middle East, it will be a huge rebirth. David, could I think you've got from Wolverhampton, very nice place, David. I think you've got something to say to us. How are you, David?
Hello.
I'm sorry, David. I can't quite. The line's pretty poor.
Can you hear me now?
I can now, David.
Right.
Can you turn your TV down?
Hold on, please.
Funny, you must keep your TVs down because it gets an echo and it causes a problem with all the electronics, by the way, so remember that.
Is that better?
David, go ahead.
All right. I have some comments about Libya.
Please, we want to hear them. That's what this show's about.
Right. According to me, or according to what I'm seeing, the governments, the European governments, what they're doing, trying to stop or trying to interfere with the Libya problem is not right, because they're doing it, you know, to try and get their own advantages or get their own things from the interference rather than to help the people. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, certainly, I think that, you know, the arguments over intervention in Libya, and, you know, it's complicated ones. Many people say that they're right to oppose the tyrant Gaddafi, but it's also wrong, I think, to avoid and ignore the reasons why Britain and France in particular led the, you know, intervention there. And, you know, we know that it's a colonial venture. I think that it suits the West to obviously prevent a government it doesn't like being in power. But I think they also thought that it might end the momentum of revolution. You've got a situation here now where perhaps other governments in Bahrain, perhaps in Saudi Arabia, are looking to Libya and think that the momentum that started so excitingly in Tunisia and then Egypt has now sort of come to an end. So that's one of the matters that I think is here in play in terms of Western involvement in Libya. Now, I think, thanks for that, David from Wolverhampton. Now, I believe we have an email coming in next. So let's have a look at what we're being sent. So Gavin from London, again nearby, telling us that Saudi Arabia claims it's defending Arabs from Iran and other countries. Number one, Bahrain hasn't been attacked by Iran or anyone. Two, Israel bombed Lebanon for 34 days. Saudi sent no soldiers to protect Arabs and even criticized Hezbollah and governments for fighting back. And number three, Israel bombed Gaza for 22 days, killing 1,400 Sunni Arabs. But no soldier from Saudi, no support from Saudi. So where is Saudi getting its orders from? Well, I mean, that's pretty, I think, straight to the point, Gavin, that Saudi Arabia is in a very close alliance with the United States. And the double standards, I think, of these nations when it comes to the Palestinians is breathtaking, particularly during the slaughter that happened in 2008-2009. Were there any calls for a no-fly zone? Was there even criticism? If there was, it was very, very muted. So I think that, you know, I think this just explains to you the history of Saudi Arabia's position, the way that the British put them in power there to control the region. And remember, a lot of it is about the three-letter word, O-I-L. And it started when oil was discovered in Persia in 1908, then in Saudi Arabia in 1930s. So, you know, you don't have to be a genius to find the causes of these alliances that have taken place. And yes, Saudi Arabia is claiming that Iran is threatening in the area. I mean, Iran and Saudis have been traditional groups that have rivalries in the areas. And Saudi Arabia keeps claiming that Iran is interfering, but there's very little evidence of that. The protests in Bahrain, where 70% of the people are Shia, is something that spontaneously came up after the protests everywhere in Tunisia, in Egypt, because they suffered the same discrimination as these people and shared their goals. Another email is coming up. This is Callahan from London. Britain recently published a human rights report, but they hardly mentioned anything about what is happening to Shias in Bahrain or why Saudi is occupying another country. Yeah, I mean, certainly some human rights reports tend to think that they can miss out politics. And as we see from that email, there was a sort of gap in that. You know, you can talk about some of the things that have happened to people, and these are all very tragic, of course, in terms of human rights, but you're not saying why it happened. And if you look at Bahrain, it's now got an occupying army, a foreign army, to control its own people. I mean, what do you think the people feel there? And remember in Bahrain as well, even the Khalifa's army, before the Saudis went in, most of those people are foreigners that have come from Pakistan, from Jordan, from elsewhere, Sunnis that have been brought in, put on a uniform, and then put down their own people. Now, no serious organization can be like that. No serious government, surely, can control their people effectively with foreigners running it. I think we've got now another caller coming in. They're coming in thick and fast. We've got Glenn from the south of England. Hello, Glenn. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. I just thought I'd call in, Phil, to comment on how naive the media reporting of the situation concerning Libya is. You know, we're told that the Americans and British and French governments are only concerned about the rights of the people being persecuted by Gaddafi. It's all about the three letter word oil, or about the massive profits being made by the munitions profiteers, and no mention also about you know, extreme double standards about the fact that Israel has been slaughtering people for God knows how long, and not one finger is Israel, Western governments. And also, of course, about the horrendous situation in Bahrain, where every book is being violated by the Bahraini monarchy. And also another factor which hasn't, I don't think, been given a lot of attention, the possibility or likelihood that France, for example, is trying to resurrect its own imperial ambitions and territorial ambitions in North Africa. Don't forget, at one time it had colonies stretching from Tunisia to the Atlantic Ocean, and it treated the citizens of those states very, very badly.
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you recall a couple of weeks ago when the UN resolution passed, you had the British Prime Minister David Cameron, the French President, Nicolas Sarkozy. They were jumping up and down as if they'd been injected by some new drug. And what were they doing? They were declaring war. And they thought this would make them more popular in their own countries. Now, you know, that's a terribly sad thing to say. The Western politicians think war can improve their ratings in the polls by killing people elsewhere, abroad, is somehow part of that. But of course, there's huge hypocrisy in the media, as you mentioned. And, you know, this comes down to the fact that when a country's at war, that nation's media can't be impartial. And, you know, you've got all the Western, and you've got indeed journalists from other organizations with the rebels in Benghazi there, and you've got a real sense of good guys and bad guys. Now, it's a lot more complicated than that, in my view. That doesn't mean that you have, you know, a choice of saying, well, do you support, if you oppose the intervention, do you support Gaddafi, who himself is a tyrant? He's killed many, many of his own people. But let's try and cut through the rubbish and really work out what's going on. And if there is a genuine attempt to help civilians, let's everybody get together to try to work out how that should be the case. And that means everybody, not just members of the UN Security Council and their loyal Arab friends. Next call, I believe, is from Ishmael in London, about NATO. Ishmael, are you there? Calling from London?
Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you for calling, sir.
I'd like to comment on really Libya and NATO and all of the involvement that they've got in Libya. First of all, I mean, having gone through that country when I went on a convoy to Palestine, I mean, we saw how, you know, the local people supported the movement, you know, of the convoy going to Palestine and in support of a oppressed, you know, community. I think moderate conspiracy theorists like myself, I think it's much more bigger than that. This thing in Libya and NATO's involvement is much more serious. They're not only going after the oil. They already own Iraqi oil and Afghani oil now, and the major pipelines are owned by the West, and they're securing that. What they're doing is stationing themselves within the Middle East. Like, I mean, there was Britain led the sort of invasion now in Libya, when clearly the Libyan people said, we don't want foreign intervention. We want just basically them to have a watchful eye. But, yeah, like you were saying, the double standards. Where was the foreign intervention when, you know, Israel was bombing the hell out of Gazans? Where was the intervention when the Zionist regime was bombing Hezbollah, that group, you know? You know,
yeah. In 2006, that war, exactly. No attempts. Nobody spoke of a no-fly zone there.
No, not even a no-fly zone. I mean, it's clear now. People can see it as clear as crystal clear that there's different agendas. What people are seeing and what they're being shown by Western media is completely different to what is actually going on there. They're going after not only just the oil in Libya, but there's a natural resource. In order for them to stay there, they're going after, there's, and this is a conspiracy theory, but the water. Libya apparently has the natural sources of water there, lots of it, and they want to be controlling that area for that resource.
Okay, well, listen, thank you for that point of view. Of course, it is you know, complicated what is going on in Libya. It's certainly not black and white, and unfortunately the media is presenting it in that way. Though I think, as a former caller said, it does give the West a foothold again when it was losing track of what was going on in the Middle East in terms of all the rebellions. And as another caller said, it might actually sort of make intervention, which had a terribly bad name in the West after the war in Iraq, it might give it a kind of a new sugar coating in Libya. And I think that's possibly an attempt to justify a new colonialism. I mean, that's certainly a view. Meher is our next caller. He's in Surrey. Thank you for calling. What have you got to say,
sir? Yeah, I wanted to speak about the Bahrain situation. And I wanted to just say that the Saudis, they're just, I seriously feel that pathetic, because what they're doing is it tells people that they're nothing but a puppet in Western hands. They're killing their fellow Muslims, and it's amazing that nobody is saying anything to them. And the other thing that amazes me is that all the human rights abuses that goes on in Saudi Arabia, West takes no notice of it. And anything goes around anywhere in the world, they just, you know, starts going on about human rights.
It's a very closed society. It's almost impossible to report freely there. I mean, it is impossible to report freely. But remember also, Mayor, that somehow there's a kind of, it's not just the West ordering these rich royal families in these Gulf states. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of power now. So I think there's a partnership between them and the West that keeps them both in power. What do you think of that?
Again, that's the thing. So they pay the West in terms of oil, and West reports nothing what goes on in there, because, if you think about it, I know it's really difficult to report from within the Saudi, but the West, they go anywhere and report anything, even things that come out of that place. The Western media don't report on it. I mean, the thing is, what's happening in Bahrain, it is appalling. And the only thing Western people are doing is just protecting their people.
Well, it's come off the news agenda, hasn't it, Meher? Well, listen, I tell you, thanks for calling. Well, I mean, do you actually agree that it is off the news agenda from what you see in Britain now, that somehow people are forgetting about it? Oh, I think Mayor's gone. Listen, Mayor, thank you for calling. And please call again next week if you can. You got some very interesting points. But I'm afraid we're coming up to a short break now. But please keep the calls coming. Remember, we are talking about Bahrain, Libya and Yemen. It's a fascinating time. There's a lot going on. There's a lot to say. Keep those calls coming. I want to hear from you. So don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. See you soon. Welcome back to Comment with me, Phil Rees, standing in for George Galloway. It's not just George losing his Scottish accent, believe me. Now, today we've been talking about Libya. Britain says it's not involved in regime change there. They're just protecting civilians. I mean, what do you think? Then there's Bahrain. Apparently earlier this week, the French president, Sarkozy, praised the Bahrainian king for bringing peace and stability for his country. Meanwhile, he's having intervention in two countries in Africa. What's that about? Yemen, tomorrow could be another day with a lot of killings. Ali Abdullah Saleh, who's, you know, this guy's been there for 32 years, all right? All his nephews, all his, and his son, they run all the security services. You know, how are they going to get rid of him? And look at the power he's got. So what do we do in Yemen? Then there's the Ivory Coast. I mean, you may have been following that on the main news. You know, this guy who lost an election, Laurent Gbagbo, he is holed up in the presidential palace there. But should the West have intervened in that way and such, and should they have taken sides, which today the Russian foreign minister said they shouldn't have done? Is it another colonial adventure? Well, these are the kind of things to talk about, but other things as well. Feel free, keep those calls in and talk about what you want to. But first of all, we have Tony from London, and I think he's on about Libya. Tony.
Well, yes, hi there. Nice talking to you. Nice program as usual. Yes, we see again as we sit back and look at the hypocrisy of the West regarding the Middle East and including Libya. They, if for example, the Iranian military went in, like Saudi sent their military into Bahrain, what would have happened? Can you imagine? The Americans would have been saying this, that, and the West would be condemning Iran. But now,
oh, but King Hamid al Khalifa invited them in. You know, they were just brought in as friends.
Yes, but they're not an elected government. They're a monarchy. This is the people. If they were invited, how come the people are protesting? It goes to show they're not a government by the people, of the people, for the people. They're just those sort of family dynasty there.
So, I mean, look, if there was democracy in Bahrain, the king would be out. I mean, 70% of the population are Shia. What do you think that the West, will they ever allow democracy? Because obviously if the Shias win, there will be a government that is leaning more towards Iran. That's inevitable, and this is behind a lot of the policies, the rivalry between Iran and the fact that Iran has the cahoots, but a challenge the West. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think the West now, as long as their interests, regardless, they don't give a damn about the lives of the people, as long as their oil interests and strategic interests are, you know, a top priority, and this is safeguard, and this is what they're worried about. They're not worried about human dignity and the sufferings of the people over there. This is just put as a gloss, you know, no-fly zone and all this. As long as someone is there to protect their interests, like the family dynasties in the Arab world, and, of course, not to mention America's surrogate baby is little Israel. We know the hidden agenda in American policy is all there to protect Israel. But let me say to the Israelis, now, let me be absolutely clear, I'm not Jewish. I'm talking about the Zionists, who have hijacked the good name of the Jews that we've come to love, respect, and admire over the years. Their good name, the Jews, have been hijacked by these bunch of haughty, arrogant, lawless
Listen, I mean, America, you know, if you look at its policies in the Middle East, it was prepared to see Mubarak go. It was prepared to see Bin Ali go from Tunisia. I mean, do you think that there isn't any sense of a belief in democracy, of any sense of openness?
Yeah, it's a very bad line. Could you repeat your...
Yeah, I'm just saying, is it complete hypocrisy from the Americans? Because, you know, they've said they do believe in democracy. They say that they'd like to see democracy unfurl in the Middle East and have greater rights for people and greater openness. I mean, even in Saudi Arabia, they've said that. Do you believe these are just hollow words?
Well, absolutely. The American talk of democracy when their interests are not involved. But when their interests are involved, then even if they're going to mix it up with hypocrisy, so be it. You know, they're very good. And we know who's behind all this. Now we come to find out, and I was speaking to an American the other day who was absolutely fed up with the Zionist influence in America. And they have this hidden agenda, who the American people did not know about until now, that they're becoming exposed more and more as the days go by, that America's policy is there to protect Israel. Well, now the Americans have just had enough of this yet.
Well, you know, this is a very interesting thing, and thank you for that call. It's very interesting that, in fact, basically, Israel has kept rather quiet about most things, and it's sometimes praised democracy in the Middle East, which is rather strange to some extent, when they had a very good situation when dictatorships ruled the neighboring countries. That's another thing you might want to talk about. But we have another call from Denmark. Abu Bakr, are you there? Good evening to you, sir.
Yeah, hello, I'm there, Phil. Yeah, Phil, what I want to comment is about Libya, because I thought we learned a lesson in Iraq, because we can see another Iraq is in the making in Libya. If this was done by the Libyans themselves, then we can understand that they themselves changed their government. But it was too quick for the West to intervene in Libya, and this shows that there is an interest in there. So, but if you ask the Iraqis today, they will say life was better under Saddam Hussein. And I believe that the Libyans themselves should learn.
Well, I mean, surely some are saying that. They're saying that only because of the terrible civil war that resulted from the American occupation.
See how many people died from the time the war started, you know, to now. And we don't want to see the same thing happen also in Libya. And it's going to be worse. We thought that they are tired of war now, but you can see another war is in the building, and we don't know how long this war will take. They can win the war, but they can never win the peace, you know. So you find out that it's another Iraq again in the Middle East.
Sure. I mean, the end game isn't really in sight. I mean, thanks for that, Abu Bakr. And I think it does raise, an important question. I mean, is there anywhere in the world that you can justify intervention? I mean, people talked about Rwanda, I think, in 1994, when 800,000 people died and felt the West stood by. And I think that, you know, is a debate. I don't think one can always say there shouldn't be intervention. Perhaps if the United Nations reflected the global community rather than the Security Council, maybe people would be more trustful of its role when it does interfere. But anyway, call coming up from Aberdeen. Zakira, excuse me pronouncing, is that right? Good evening to you, Zakira.
Yeah, good evening to you, sir. Thank you so much for calling me. And I would like to say, regarding the old mismanagement of the world, and this is went down, is going to the Security Council, the way the resolution are passed and the way is executed. In this respect, the Security Council should be in the form from the three stages. One, the General Security Council, and then technical, and then the decision making, which should be of international judges. And then, when regarding the say military resolution, the apparatus and the military power should come under the control of the Security Council, and those generals that in Security Council that control this one, they should not be from the countries that they give those power to them. And
do you think the General Assembly should have more power, though? That basically
no. Security Council should have the three stages of the decision making and control and the execution of the power.
But it's dominated by the United States, by Britain, by France, and then they do deals with China and Russia, and then, you know, sometimes that policy goes through. Whereas much of the Muslim world, much of the developing world, unless they happen to be a member of the Security Council for a short time, you know, they're not consulted.
Well, this is what it is. This is the age of the people, of the nations. The nation should rise against the barbarism in the Security Council and the colonialism and the dictatorship. That weight of veto right, it is a colonialism. It is a barbarism. It is a dictatorship. There is no democracy in the Security Council. How these barbarians, they will abuse every law to destroy the entire world, especially the Muslim world.
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, thank you for that. You've raised a lot of interesting points there, one of which, of course, is the fact that there's no Muslim nation, a permanent member of the Security Council, and very often people feel that the voices of the Muslim world are simply not heard. Because, I mean, do you feel, I mean, you know, what practical can be done, though? I mean, do you think that the people who are now in, you know, the General Assembly, who feel they don't have a voice, and, you know, we hear speeches every September when world leaders meet there, what would you like to see done to reform the United Nations?
The Security Council and the United Nations General Assembly, they should be reformed, and the international law, they should be reformed, that is, radical reforms, and in execution of the resolution, they should be a different body, and all the forces, all the military forces in this case, should come under the control and of the Security Council, and they should be exactly defined when they should act, not they give it to NATO or the American. They go and open the new crusade war against Muslims. And
they get the mandate to do that from the Security Council.
Sorry?
They get the mandate to do that, NATO and the American forces, from the Security Council.
This is what is wrong. The wrong is from the Security Council, because they pass a resolution and put it on the table. Somebody take it, colonial power, they take it and they go and do whatever they want for their own interest. This is what is problem in the world.
Yeah.
The management of the system of the Security Council, it is a barbaric way of the management of the world affairs. This is what is it.
But what do you think of the United Nations in general? I mean, doesn't the UN maybe have a role to play where there are conflicts in the world, where there's horrible things going on in certain countries? Do you think that the whole UN, including a real voice of the world, could make them a genuine sort of police force, not a military force, but a police force that could exercise certain global principles where people agree on?
In this respect, the General Assembly of the United Nations should have the ultimate...
Oh, I think we lost you there. I think we got your point, though, that basically the United Nations could do is reform. Zachary, thank you there. But, I mean, I think that it's true in many senses. I think that the UN has reached a kind of end of its line in some extent. Because, you know, if you look, every year world leaders meet in New York and there are discussions on the floor, and really, they don't achieve anything. You've got the whole world there, and yet when it comes to anything that the United Nations done, it's in the Security Council, it's got the five permanent members, and then those do a lot of horseplay with the other countries that are temporarily on it, and you've got a rather corrupt backroom system, not something that reflects global opinion and genuinely universal values, which also would reflect much more the Muslim point of view. Well, calls will keep coming in. Keep them. But we also have an email. So I think we've got an email next. Well, this is from Nick from Manchester. Can anyone seriously believe that the United States would let Bahrainis rule by themselves while the U.S. has a big military base there and need it protected? Saudi's intervention to suffocate the protests in Bahrain is related to military bases. And of course, the U.S. would always use its proxies in the region, i.e. Saudi Arabia and other GCC countries. Well, I mean, certainly the 7th, I'm sorry, the 5th fleet, the 7th fleet is in Japan. America has these bases around the world, about 800 of them. It can be confusing, but the 5th fleet based in Bahrain, it runs a lot of the war in Afghanistan, by the way. It's very, very important to the Americans. So to say that isn't a factor would obviously be somewhat naive. And when you talk about the Gulf Cooperation Council, now, for those of you who don't know, that involves Qatar, all the Gulf states there, the oil-rich royalties. Well, you know, of course they work with America because their interest. They get richer, America gets it oil. There's a sort of partnership. To disrupt that is a problem. Now, another call's coming in. Hassan from Woking.
Hi there, Phil.
Hi, Hassan. Salams.
Great to have you on the show. You're doing a fantastic job.
Thank you, mate. Appreciate it.
Okay, if you don't mind, I'd like to take you back to Bahrain for just a moment. The thing with Bahrain at the moment is the Saudis have sent in their troops. They're savaging the Bahrainian Shia majority. Recently, they've desecrated a mosque. And I'd like to sort of pick your brains, because I know you're bit of an expert on Hezbollah. I would like to ask you, isn't this reminiscent of how the Israelis had treated Hezbollah when they invaded the south of Lebanon and had launched several attacks on the Shia minority in the south, and how the turning point for Hezbollah came when the mosque or the bombing of Qana took place, and that really reignited the fire within Hezbollah, and therefore they fought back the Israeli army. I mean, do you compare the Bahrainian situation to the Lebanese situation?
Well, to some extent, obviously, the two attacks on Qana were brutal, highly murderous, you know, and really terrible events. But, you know, it's interesting, you talk about the Sunni-Shia divide, you know, which is true in Bahrain, there is one. But let me just make a few points on that. And, you know, first of all, I've traveled a lot in, say, the West Bank in Palestine, and it's very interesting that these are Sunnis, and you see on the wall, you see photographs of Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah. He is a hero there, so they don't necessarily look at it in that sectarian way. I mean, Bahrain's a little more complicated in the sense that 70% of the people have been discriminated against, and they are mostly Shia. But the truth is, there are Sunnis who want democracy. The issue is about democracy. The issue is about, should the majority rule, or should this tiny elite who've kept power based on a royalty that has governed for 200 years and their mates and their allies, should they just reap all the rewards from the country? So I think to emphasize the Shia-Sunni debate, while it's a real one, shouldn't really be done too much when it comes to basic principles of democracy. At least that's my view. Next, we have Marcia from London. Pleased to have you on, Marcia. Glad to have another lady.
Hello, good
evening. Hello, Marcia. Please go ahead. Okay. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'd like to take on the point that you raised. You said about sugarcoating this intervention. Well, I wrote to the Russian and Chinese embassies, and I told them they're going to regret it, because the sugarcoating you're talking about has been given by those jokers. They are the ones who are giving the what do you say, a Muslim face to it.
Well, I mean, they, you know, they are, Marcia. I mean, you know, the point is that what the West tries to get, and Israel has tried to get allies. I mean, if you remember how, for example, you know, Hosni Mubarak would meet Israeli leaders in Sharm el-Sheikh, have a sort of love-in with them, and that would achieve a couple of things. It would dissipate Arab anger, because here's a Muslim and an Arab, you know, embracing an Israeli, and the Israelis came out of that saying they were men of peace. So, I mean, I think that principle applies, that you get an ally in the Muslim world, and then you can somehow speak on behalf of Muslims, and I think that's very much going on now in Bahrain, and we've seen, of course, Robert Gates, the U.S. Defense Secretary, be touring the region, meeting King Abdullah, and you know, a major general was in Bahrain as well. So certainly they're all heavily involved in that, and sugarcoating war. And if I can just one thing, having covered war for 30 years, There ain't no such thing. War is brutal. War is murderous. War kills people. It kills babies. And I'm afraid the West now has tried to present intervention as something which is sort of nice. It's made war nice. Never, never believe that. And anybody who's experienced war should know that. And in fact, on that subject, I think we've got Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller. I think he's in Benghazi. We've seen him the last few days running around from one place to another. Johnny, are you there?
Hi there. How are you?
I'm fine, Johnny. How are you, mate? Are you safe?
I am safe, yes, yes. In Benghazi.
Okay.
I haven't been to the front line today. I'm staying in Benghazi, so I'm very safe.
Okay, but listen, I mean, you know, we can't be too long here because we've come to the end of the show, but, you know, we've seen the to-ing and fro-ing of each side for the last 10 or 15 days. I mean, do you see an end of that, or do you see a kind of stalemate that's emerged now?
Well, quite frankly, there doesn't seem to be an end in sight. Yes, there's been stalemate between Belaga and Ashdabia for almost a week now, and, yeah, there doesn't seem to be an end in sight. The revolutionaries say they have two-pronged strategy here, the military and the political, and the military doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. It's clear that Gaddafi forces are far better trained and equipped than revolutionary forces, and it's only NATO airstrikes which cancel that out. And politically, we haven't seen too many changes there either. There was hope that Gaddafi's regime would crumble, but there hasn't been too much crumbling happening either. So stalemate. And there doesn't seem to be an end in sight. I spoke to a British official earlier today who said that their aim is still a unified Libya with no Gaddafi, but day by day it's just becoming less and less clear how that's going to happen.
Johnny, thank you for that. So you actually mean a divided Libya might be a prospect for the future?
Well, possibly. People in the East are very scared of that. One reason they're not too keen on a ceasefire is because if there is a ceasefire, then that will make the front line area between Ashdabia and Brega more pronounced and clarify a split in the country. So if there is a ceasefire, then that's a fear in the East that partition may well be the next step.
Okay, Johnny. Well, listen, thank you for that analysis, and stay safe and hope to hear from you again on Press TV. We have another call in. Bob from Wiltshire. Bob, how are you?
Hey, I'm fine. How about yourself?
Ah, great, mate. And you got something to say about Libya, then? What's your thoughts?
Well, initially it was about... I might be ingenuous, but I sort of thought that the reason we're going for Gaddafi is because he's such a despot, like Mugabe and so on. We have been self-serving in the past by sucking up to him for financial reasons, but I don't think that that most of the people think that we're doing this for self-serving purposes. The point is that Gaddafi himself is completely self-serving, secret police, not looking after his people, salting away billions.
No, but he was a tyrant. But I mean, do you think that the West is there purely for altruistic reasons?
I would hope so.
But do you believe that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, there's
in the case of Britain, you see.
But why not? You know, why not then? Why not go to Bahrain? Why not go to Yemen? I mean, why Libya?
Because the man is about as Nazi as you can get.
Well, there's been no indication when he's entered towns that he has actually committed atrocities at all. The sort of accusations that were being made, none of that's happened. When he's gone into towns and he's reoccupied, he hasn't done anything that would constitute a genocide.
See that, because of the secret police. There was another thing I wanted to bring up. Was about why does religion come into all this in the first place?
Well, I tell you, we haven't got a lot to talk about that, but, you know, because we come to the end of the show. Perhaps that's something for next week on religion. But listen, I appreciate you joining us, and thank you very much, but we are coming to the end of the show. So thanks for all your calls and messages. We'll have it next week. I'd love to join you, but stay tuned for the upcoming news on Press TV. And from me, Phil Rees, goodbye for now. Take care.
Hello, just comment on your name and the place you left that number. And just make sure that your television volume is set to 0.
0, 0. Can you spell your name for me?
Yeah, I know. You redirect me through the phone number.